Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Good morning. I'm Lady Sue, your host on Word of Mouth. And summer is over. Not really comfortable with this sharp and scary demarcation that is a Labor Day. And are we all awake yet, everybody out there? Today's show theme kind of came together as really endless summer. We're going to talk about all the stuff that's still kind of happening, but soon to go away. And let's see, what's on tap today? Well, you and I are going to catch up a little bit, stuff that I'm obsessed with lately. And then we're going to have the one and only David Rosengarten. He is our special guest. He was the host of the first ever show on the Food Network, believe it or not. And then after that, we're going to wind down with some talk of Riesling to say bye-bye to summer. So, you know, I'm really enjoyed my staycation this weekend. Saturday ended up going out to the Rockaways. A little bit of a hipster Hamptons, I think. There's so much amazing stuff going on, and I think the area really needs it post Sandy. You know, Back 40, Shauna, hello, Chef Shauna of Back 40 did a crab boil, and Aaron of Heritage Radio and I went out there and we stuffed our faces with crab. Folks like, you know, Roberta's and other New York City food makers do stuff out there. Plus, there's Playland Motel. It's this amazing new property out there. Every single room is designed by a different artist. So my favorite room happens to be this one by Kate Payne. I don't know a lot about her, but I just, you kind of have to see it for yourself. Do a little Google search. It's called Coconut Castle, and the description is a hot and heavy girlhood frolic with glitter, sunburn, ponies, and wet swimsuits. Isn't that freaking awesome? You have to go check it out. I just think that people out there just get a little bit less aggressively drunk than in the Hamptons, and so it makes for a nice, good time, and it's only an hour away instead of maybe 3 hours. Sunday, went to Shea Jose and Pam Young, formerly of Issa's, Pig Roast Sundays at Crown Victoria. And next weekend, Sunday, 3:30 to about 8-ish, is the last one of the summer. It's freaking amazing. Shea Jose, he'll cut you a slice of jowl, a slice of loin, a slice of belly, and if you're really lucky, a slice of pig foot. And then to top it off, you know, Pam, she makes this delicious smoked vanilla ice cream. So it's kind of like, it's amazing. It's like having fine dining dessert, but in the backyard of a bar in Williamsburg. Again, Crown Victoria next Sunday, 3:30 and on. Last one of the summer. Catch it. You know, I'm balking at how banana September is going to be. And I know everyone out there, food or not, you are all pursuing deals and jobs and opportunities and what have you. And it can be excruciating to always be, you know, pitching and selling and getting shit done. And kind of what I came out of this summer realizing is that, you know what, it's about the foundering and floundering and flailing and failing. And it's about the journey. It's about all of the people that you run into along the way. You have lots of conversations. They're mostly great. It may not work out, but those people are going to come back. They're going to show up again in your life and your personal and professional doings, and kind of like have a little bit of peace in that, because it can be hard to hustle in the city. So that's my inspirational thought of today. And now now it is time for where I bring on a guest. My guest today, David Rosengarten. Time for... Ooh.
People we like.
Okay.
That's
so,
not me.
I wouldn't be surprised if it were you, because you're such a clown.
I am.
But by the way, I want to tell you, actually, you must be wondering who are these ladies that are singing for my show. They're actually food music people.
Okay.
Like, we know so many amazing music people and food people. Okay, so Jackie Gordon. Hi, Jackie. She tweets behind Diva That Ate NY. She's a singing chef. She did the intro. She's doing a show that is October 20th, Choc Cabaret. She sings you through a chocolate tasting. So check it out, JackieGordon.com. She's amazing.
Quick suggestion to really make the point. You should have them sometime sing that beautiful voice with their mouths full.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Absolutely. No. You are full of ideas always. And then I have to tell you a little bit about Lisa Maisie. She's at Reset. She does events there. And then she's also at Nourish. So both ladies are talented and delicious. And so David Rosengarten,
Who is he, really?
He hosted the first show on the Food Network. And by the way, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su, and today, special guest David Rosengarten on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. And David has also written for pretty much every single food media company.
Yep.
Magazine,
put them all out of
everything,
business.
And was formerly the restaurant critic for Gourmet Magazine. And I'll stop. But okay. You know what? Most importantly is that he is the world's most fun person to eat with. So, okay. You know what? Tell me, I want to know a little bit.
Can I tell you something first?
Yeah.
I grew up in Rockaway.
Oh.
Where you just were.
And
okay. It was totally unhipster when I grew up there. But the big deal in Rockaway then was going to Rockaway's Playland. Is that still there with the roller coaster and all that?
I don't know.
So my dad and I, about 10:30 every night, we lived on 133rd Street, right on the beach. That's probably no longer there. But we used to go down to 98th Street across from Rockaway's Playland to a place that was owned by an Italian guy and an Irish guy. It was called Boggiano and McWalters. And they had a griddle that yielded the greatest hamburgers and hot dogs, and that's what we used to do. That was eating in the Rockaways for me back then.
And you did that piece for the HuffPo on how the fat that's baked and griddled into the griddles across America's diners actually flavors the new burgers that are slapped on there. And
There's like, people think a hamburger has to be on a grill. Of course a hamburger's great on a grill, but a griddle has its own joys. You know, why do people overlook that?
Okay. I loved that. It was just, there's just like these little tiny nerdy things that,
nerdy,
that we,
yes,
like, just were like, we freak out about.
Yes.
And you are actually Rosengarten. You are Jewish.
Rosengarten. I'm actually, you know, the way they say it in Germany when I go there, it's very scary. They go, Herr Rosengarten. Yes, I suppose that's me. Yeah, my father's father was David Rosengarten from Hamburg. Jewish, three Russian Jews. Yes, Jewish all around. Yes. Yes, I admit it. Bye.
So last meal would be?
My last meal on Earth? A selection of shellfish, including raw oysters, and then a big pile of pork sausages.
with the Riesling and so on and so forth that you're now importing. So let's get people, you know, before we delve more deeper in your past, what are you up to these days?
Yes, Leyte, I have, you know, for years, my take on wine has been that wine is for food. duh. There's just too much wine drinking in this country that's not with food. I just like the way they do it in Europe. You know, the meal comes up, you have the wine, you have your cheese, your bread, your meat, your salad, your wine. You know, it's just natural. This whole thing of having a cocktail of a glass of red wine, ew! In Europe, they think that's nuts. So I have been on the hunt for my whole career for the kinds of wines that go easily, deliciously with food. And they're not always so easy to find in American wine shops. So I have created this thing. It's 10 categories of wine that you can count on. And each category goes with something. So it's like, Dave, I'm having a rare roast beef tonight. What category should I pick? Category 8, you know. And then you can dive right into the category, pick out one of the wines that I'm importing in that category, and know what to serve with your food. So far, I haven't filled up the categories yet, but so far, as it's worked out, because of a big trip I took to Germany last winter, which was fun, driving around in the snow with my GPS to find little winemakers, I have a lot of aged, dry German Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people think that German, it's sweet, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, some of it is, but 75% of what they make and drink in Germany is bone dry, and it goes so well with food.
And I have to say that it's been, you know, the summer that I've, when I'm not here with you all hanging out with people we like, some days I'm at Terroir on the High Line, and it's been really hilarious, entertaining tourists from Austria and Germany, and they're quite flattered that Paul Greco and the team, we're pouring Rieslings, and that's all we pour, and that's all people can drink at our establishments, and they're delighted.
Yeah, lady is speaking, of course, of one of her bosses, a guy named Paul Greco, who is like the guru of Riesling in the U.S., and he's done so much to promote it. But I'm interested to hear, lady, something I didn't know, but Germans and Austrians in New York City find their way to Paul Greco to pay tribute? Is that sort of what's happening?
I think that people are walking along the High Line and then they go, oh, look, there seems to be something to eat and drink here. And then they sit down and then people are like, what? Wait, is all the wines, is this all you have? Like, and there's a lot of text in this content-heavy menu that is what Terroir does. And then they kind of come up to me and they're like, what is this on your t-shirt and why do you have this funny tattoo? So there's this whole campaign around Riesling, and you know, actually, that's going to be my we're getting ahead of ourselves. That's going to be my wine it down.
Oh, but
okay. Let's get it back to you.
Let's get it back
because we have you for this special moment. Okay,
this
so
magic moment.
In fact, you and I met at this Wines of Germany tasting.
We did
amongst very old Riesling, and thank you to our friend Justin from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt for being like, hey, David, Leite, what up? How are you? Like, and then we started nerding out about the state of wine drinking in America and sort of why Americans are so have this insecurity around wine. And do you think there's been an evolution within your career of how Americans and New Yorkers approach wine? And is, you know, there's been a lot of progress. Like, how would you?
Are we back to wine now?
Yeah, I just want to know kind of because
I thought you said we're going to save that for wine down.
So you know what it is yeah. That I do feel like maybe we take wine bars in New York for granted. Like, you know, you can walk down the street and there's Bar Veloce, there's Terroir, there's Cork Buzz, and maybe it wasn't like that 10 or 20 years ago.
No, it wasn't. There were wine bars, but it was kind of like, did you hear a wine bar opened on Prince Street? What? What's that? You know. Yeah, I mean, American attitudes towards wine definitely have changed. It's no secret we're not a wine-drinking nation. You go to a place like France or Italy or Spain or Greece, and they're drinking wine all the time. I think the latest stat I saw was something like 10% of Americans drink wine on a regular basis with their meals. That's not acceptable, people! Why is that? Well, I think one reason is that wine is way overpriced all the time. You know, people think that they have to drink expensive wine to really be drinking wine. I think it's the opposite. I think when you're in Europe and you find a bottle of wine at a restaurant that costs like $10 or less, that's wine drinking. know, just throw it back, get the next one. You know, that's really wine drinking.
Open that bottle.
Open that bottle. Pop that cork. Yeah. So we have to learn that. You know, we tend to worship these wines with high scores and all that. When I see a wine with a high score, I kind of run in the opposite direction. I don't want no more high score. There's a theater artist who once said, "No more masterpieces." That's what I think we should say about wine. Mm-hmm. Just drink your little dry Riesling, your little Beaujolais, your little simple Chianti. I'm having a party later this week that's going to make some Italian-American food. You know what I'm looking for this week? Chianti in a woven fiasco. You know, do you know those straw bottles?
Oh, yes.
I want to serve that at my party.
The old school, I tried to incorporate that into a Halloween costume, but could not find the Chianti and the straw thingamabobber.
Yeah.
To be like a, I don't know, like I wanted to be like a, like instead of a German beer maid, I wanted to be like a wine.
Italian wine wench.
Yeah, wine wench, yes. And it didn't happen. But tell me where you find it.
Well, I'll save my bottle for you so you can have
you.
It soon.
Okay. So we also talked a little bit, okay, what, actually, rewind, how did you become the first ever show host on the Food Network? What happened?
It's a really interesting story, but it would definitely run into the evening news if I told it all. But in a nutshell, I had an agent who was, my book agent, who was urging me to contact this guy who's a TV producer. This was in 1993 or 4. And I resisted, but I finally contacted him. I got him on the phone. He said, "Well, it's Sunday night. I'm packing to go to France for 6 months, and I'll see you when I come back. Wait a second, where do you live? Oh, you live around the corner. Okay, I'll come by." So this guy came by my apartment on a Sunday night. I showed him a pilot I had done with WGBH, and he said, "You're pretty good on TV. Tomorrow I'm having, before I go to France, I'm having lunch with Reese Schoenfeld." Do you know who that is? No. He's starting this thing called the Food Network. Have you heard of that? No. "Do you mind, Dave, if he asks me for talent suggestions, do you mind if I bring up your name?" No. So he did. Excuse me. And then the next day I got a call from the Food Network. "Could you send us this tape that you showed to Charles Pinsky?" Sure. Then the next day, "Could you meet us on 57th Street at the studio?" Sure. So I get there, and I'm suddenly in a black box, and there's a woman there who turned out to be Donna Hanover, the wife of the soon-to-be mayor of New York, Giuliani, and they say, "Okay, you two, talk." "About what?" "Just talk. Talk about lunch." "Okay, Donna, I had a tuna salad sandwich for lunch. It was very, very good." And then this guy comes out of the shadows. He goes, "Well, Donna, I think we have our co-anchor." And that was it. And, you know, like suddenly I had a 2-year contract to do a live show every day because they thought that this kind of news show, news and talk show, which they called Food News and Views, was going to be the center of the Food Network. It turned out not to be so, but it did run for 6 or 7 years.
So the Food Network has come a long way.
Yes.
Since then.
Yes, it has.
And so we've got this universe of food contest shows that do very, very well. In fact, you know, TV is the thing that so often empowers chefs to go on and open restaurants to get investors. I mean, I love that about the Food Network, about TV, about empowerment. Where is food TV, you know, what's your take on food TV now and where it's going next and what's going to happen?
Well, the big thing is this. So I started working in 94, and at that time, a lot of the early shows were very foodie, lots of food information, and we're all gone now, but the reason we left, I'd say it was probably the early 2000s, you know, 2001, 2003, they put it this way, and it's a very interesting way to look at it. They said that we set out to get every foodie in America watching the Food Network. They said, now, 8-9 years later, we have succeeded. They're all watching, except there's not enough of them. And I remember one exec said to me, "We have hit the foodie ceiling." So that means that now they have to seek other audiences because it takes a lot of money to run a TV network.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed to really expand their viewership, and they figured that the transmission of hardcore food information is probably not what's going to raise the viewership. So they got into, as you know, kind of reality shows and contests and all that kind of stuff. And it's different. It's just totally different programming than it was at the beginning. Yeah. And if they're attracting, I think the company's doing very well. And if they're attracting a large amount of viewers, hey, that can't be a bad thing. I mean, it means that there's more excitement about food in America. I really think that food in America has changed so much in the last 20 years. I mean, you know, this is obvious what I'm saying, incredibly, in what people know about food and all that, the excitement about food. And I think a lot of that has to do with food on television.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, what do you, there's this, okay, so I've noticed, let's tiptoe around the word foodie because it makes me wince.
Yeah, do you have a better word?
I call it that I love to eat, or
you see, that's clumsy. Eater. Yeah. We used to say gourmet, but that started to make people wince.
Ooh. That's like Oriental.
Do you know where, yes, Oriental, right. Do you know where the word foodie came from originally?
No.
There was a book that was published in the early 80s written by a very funny American who lives in England, but he's become quite English. He's a food writer. He's still around. Paul Levy is his name. Huh. And he wrote a book called The Foodie Handbook. And it was just when people were starting to have this food consciousness, early 80s. And he didn't mean it as anything other than it's kind of funny. The foodie, he coined the term. And for those of us who were around, we still remember the kind of tongue-in-cheekness of it. So I say foodie. I think it's okay, but I know it's a little played out.
I think maybe I'm. Okay, well, what do you despise about what, anything you despise about the foodie scene of today?
I like it. See, I was just saying a nice thing about what's happened to American foodies, or what, eat what it is, what did you say, whatever, but eaters, I think it's really good that it happened, but I don't like it when it focuses more on flash and sizzle and personality than when it focuses on good food. I wrote a piece last week on my website about a restaurant in the Hamptons, of all places, in Bridgehampton.
How far you've come.
What?
How far you have come.
How far I have come. I used to never go there, but now I go a couple of times a summer, kicking and screaming. No, no, there's some nice things out there. But anyway, this place called Osteria Selena in Bridgehampton. And as I was eating this food, and then I met the woman who's owner and chef, and she's in the kitchen like at 8 in the morning, and she comes out finally at midnight when the restaurant is closed. That food tasted, I called it her thumbprint. It tasted like her. I don't know what she tastes like, but it tasted like her somehow. I could tell that every dish had like years of taste in her mouth in the dish. And I didn't even need to meet her. I don't need to know who she is. I don't need to know anything. I just know that I was eating with a chef who's making food that really reflects something individual. That's what I like, and I worry that we lose a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
We lose it to the sizzle and the, you know, the glitz and the glam and all that stuff. I want people, I think, I mean, and this could be kind of a prediction, I guess, but I want more of this thumbprint cuisine. I don't get it at three-star restaurants. I mean, what you get at three-star restaurants is
assembly line.
Yes, but Let it be said, an amazing assembly.
Amazing.
Line. I mean, like talent and the organization. Oh, it's incredible what they do.
It's ridiculous.
But I don't get the thumbprint.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a little bit more thumbprint going on with the hipster dining.
Yeah.
With Shiraz Noor, a former GM of Asuka. Now, the only New York City restaurant to make it on Bon Appetit's top 10 best new restaurants.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. I was just jazzed. I mean, it's right down the street from me.
Yeah, you and I were supposed to go there, in fact.
Oh, we're going to put that back on the calendar. Yeah. So we talked, you know, hipster dining, allowing for chefs to be nerdy, to do their own thing, for small food producers to make their ice cream and kombucha and
yeah,
and this and that. And what advice would you, having been a food personality and, you know, your whole world is, all your friends are food personalities, for chefs and other folks who want to get more power behind what they're working on from a media standpoint or from a you know, being out there. What's kind of your advice on that front?
You know, I do a lot of cooking as well, just personal cooking, and then recipes for print and mm-hmm. cookbooks and things like that. Nothing has inspired me as much in my time cooking as travel. I know so many chefs in the U.S., mm-hmm. let's say they're in their 20s or early 30s, and they're making Italian food or Spanish food or Chinese food or whatever food, and they've never been to these places. Now, it's a good theoretical argument. Is it necessary? Well, I guess it's not necessary, but it's just something. When you go there and you breathe in that air and you see those markets and you go into a kitchen and see, he does it that way. And I mean, there's like 1,000 years of tradition there for you to look at. Why not go look at it? Of course, somebody could say, I don't need no stinking travel. You know, I do what I do, you know, but that's great. I want you to ultimately do what you do, but I want you to, you know, I used to teach theater and I maybe teach like young playwrights, and they would start writing plays without having read any plays. You can't do that. You got to know what's gone on before.
Absolutely. There's a lot to be said for learning viscerally in the world of food, cooking, food business, just really understanding, for example, what it takes to put together a party, you know, or a restaurant, or, you know, that ice is very important.
Yeah.
People forget that.
Yeah.
How many countries have you been to?
You know, I never counted, but if I had a guess, I would say it's probably somewhere between 60, 70, 75, something like that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I got a lot of frequent flyer. I don't actually, you know, I screw up on that. I don't have my card. I don't have my number. I can't believe how many flights I've missed the opportunity to take. But anyway, I travel a lot. I travel probably every year right now. I take, I don't know, 5 or 6 trips to other places. Now I have this new gig, lady, because I'm importing wine. So I go out and I find wine.
That's just an excuse to travel.
Yes, that's probably what it is. But, you know, I it's different. But I'm still going out as a journalist. So it's cool. I go out with all these hats. I should literally get hats. Journalist hat. Look like Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter. And then my wine. What kind of hat would a wine importer wear?
Like something very fancy and royal. Or
a Panama hat, you know, sort of wide brim, something.
You have to bring your cigar with you.
Bring your cigar. So anyway, but I get to do this, and it's cool. So coming up, I don't have any Italian wines yet in my portfolio, and I love all things Italian, of course. So I'm going to Italy next month to find wines from Tuscany, Emilia-Romagna, and Sicily. And it'll be cool. And at the same time, I'll be eating quite seriously and writing food and travel stories from the road while I'm finding vino.
And we are live at the Heritage Radio Studios on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Leyte Sue here with food and wine writer and person who's done everything yummy, David Rosengarten. On Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue. David, let's go back to food media for a second, because I want to know what's in the future, both print and online and TV. Like, what do you hope to see? What are we going to see?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I of course will give you only the most self-serving of answers, but you know, it was interesting to be alive and to be in love with food all those many years ago, let's say 20, 30 years ago. Let's say 30 years ago, I already knew a lot about food because I came from a food-crazed family, and I had a career where I could spend the weekend just cooking. I was a college professor, and man, okay, I already read Hamlet. I don't have to read it again, but I can explore the cuisine of Vietnam, you know, so I did a lot of that, and by the time I was ready to step up to the plate, I had a lot of knowledge. And it was interesting to talk to people, let's say in the late 70s, about food, because Americans didn't really know that much about it then. And I would be doing a dinner party. Hey, Dave, what are you going to make for the dinner party on Saturday night? I thought I'd make a moussaka. And I remember doing this actually in Cambridge with all my well-educated Harvard friends there. And they all went, what is that? What? It's moussaka. It's like the most iconic Greek dish. What's in it? You know, I mean, so low was the general knowledge back then. Nobody knew anything. And, you know, it was kind of cool to be the one who knew something, you know. But now I know more, even more, but what's come up all around me is amazing. Like, now everybody knows everything. See that guy over there setting the table? If I said to him, where's your favorite moussaka? He said, you go to Astoria, you go to this place, you know. I mean, everybody knows everything. But
he doesn't know we're talking about him.
He doesn't know. We're looking at him through a glass window, and he's just putting down forks and knives, and it's kind of cool.
They're setting up for service at Roberta's.
Yeah. So the problem is that now that when people knew nothing, they were very open to like, well, tell me about that. But now kind of everybody knows everything, and everybody gets an opportunity to talk about everything, like on the internet. And basically what's happened is, you know, magazines and big institutions of journalism have been replaced by this very democratic, popular voice. Everybody who knows everything. Is that a good thing? I don't know. Before I go there, what do you think, lady? You think that's a good thing?
I think that it hurts me sometimes because people who don't necessarily stop to be journalistic, to do their research, to take the time to and the money to eat everywhere, both in the city and around the world, give their opinion in a way that can be abrasive and uninformed. But I'm all about people having conversations, and in fact, you should tweet at us.
Yeah.
D_Rosengarten. That's on Twitter, David Rosengarten. And I'm at Leitihsu, Leitihsu. And the hashtag is #WomWithLeiti. Because all I ever wanted in life was to have a show that I could hashtag Wom. But Wom, too many people talk Wom. You know, there's too many Woms out there, and it really hurts me. And I was up late last night reading best practices on Twitter hashtags. But, you know, okay, seriously, though, I'm quite fine with it. And in fact, you know, we talk about Yelp reviews and all that. And I think if you have a place, a core of knowledge, even when I read Yelp reviews, I can get sort of a gut feeling for what the place is all about, even if I'm taking it with many grains of salt. So, you are your own filter. You know, we respect every person as somebody who can pick and choose for themselves. I always like to treat my audiences like I like them, like I do like them, and that they are smart. And so that's kind of how I like to navigate what I do. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, you know, we did lose an important filter. Just let it be said. Mm-hmm. I mean, I too have mixed feelings about it, but the filter was when I started to write, I wrote, I guess my first story was published in Gourmet magazine in 1983, and they had no idea who I was, but I wrote a story about, guess what, something that I've come to really dislike, but it was, there is this new thing from Italy. It's called balsamic vinegar. And I wrote a story for Gourmet in 1983, and I created like 10 recipes, and I sent it off to strangers, and they wrote back a month later, and they said, here's a check. We liked the story. We tested the recipes, and it got into Gourmet magazine. We don't have that filter anymore. You know, those people at Gourmet, the editor and the editorial board, they worked as a kind of filter. They would receive many submissions, and the only way that you could have your stuff read by people then was to have it in a magazine. There's no internet. There's no other way to do it. So that board would filter out 95% of what they got, said this person doesn't write well, or this person doesn't know what he or she is talking about, and so on and so forth. So now anybody can be read any day, any minute. Blah, 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 blah. There it is. Read it. And, you know, it's good. Democracy's good. On the other hand, did you know, Leitihsu, that our old Greek friend Plato, he was anti-democratic. It's very interesting. And there's a whole stream of anti-democratic thought throughout intellectual history. Mm. Plato said, in my ideal state, the Republic, the ruler is going to be trained from birth to be a ruler. So that ruler is a professional ruler.
Harvard Business School.
What?
Just like Harvard Business yes. School.
None of this voting crap because, you know, the voters, what do they know?
I save people from themselves all day long at the wine bar.
Say that again?
I save people from themselves all day long at the wine bar.
While they're reading Plato?
Have this Riesling, not that one.
Oh, yeah. Right. So, you know, it's a fine line between, you know, what's good in society. Obviously, we're making this into a bigger issue right now, which is kind of fun, but it's a fine line between having everybody empowered or having people looking towards, you know, central figures that are professionals. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know.
Well, sometimes I've learned that people want to be told, want to be guided, you know, because in life, now we're inundated with options. And, you know, by the way, that stuff has to taste good, has to look beautiful. I mean, there's so many options out there that if you're not delivering something delicious and gorgeous, then you might get lost in the noise. So maybe in a way, this is Darwin, where, you know, speaking of large bodies of thought.
Yes, there we go.
Things simmer up and may the best win.
Yes, but on the other hand, you have certain instances in the history of democracy. Don't mean to piss off any of your listeners, but how the hell did we ever reelect W?
Exactamente. So, you know, you have you know what? You mentioned gourmet, and I have to ask, what was the most, as a fellow writer, and actually as a fellow person who has been in the hallowed halls of gourmet, now RIP, what was the most pleasurable restaurant review that you wrote for gourmet?
Oh, God.
Pleasurable.
That's interesting. Okay, I'll just say about the most memorable.
Mm-hmm.
There was a thing going on, I guess, in the late 90s. A certain critic for the New York Times, who shall be nameless, I guess, but you all know who I mean. She, that's a big clue, she was writing some really wrong stuff about Le Cirque. She turned the way she was treated by Sirio into the very point of her reviews. And it's a long, interesting story. But anyway.
You mean with disguises and such?
Yeah, she, you know, Sirio told me at one point, you know, that she's coming back for another review. How do you know that? Isn't she in disguises? Yeah, she wears the nose and the hat. But I go over to her and I go, lady, would you like some caviar? You know, the whole series that she did about that restaurant, I just thought was wrongheaded. Because, as I said in my review, Le Cirque is not a one-night stand. Le Cirque is a relationship. And that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. You know, they take care of their best customers. And so I really wanted to nail the food. She finally capitulated and said, oh, this is a 4-star restaurant again, and so on and so forth, because the lady with the hat was treated nicely. I knew it wasn't a 4-star restaurant. I mean, I love the Maccioni's, and at times it's been a 4-star restaurant, but I asked Gourmet if I could spend all my dining time that month just on Le Cirque. Because normally I would do 3 reviews from New York City. Mm-hmm. So they said yes. And I went to Le Cirque, I think, maybe 12 to 15 times and tasted everything on the menu at least once, sometimes twice. And, you know, that's one important thing for a restaurant critic, to be able to taste a lot of different things on the menu. I know that if you pick up like a, let's say, neighborhood newspaper in New York that's not paying its writer, and you look at the, quote, restaurant review, well, my husband and I had the fruit cocktail as the first course, and then Ben had the salmon, which was a little dry. You know, whenever you see that chronological one, we tasted a total of 4 dishes kind of review, you know it's ersatz. So anyway, 15 times, I think, at Le Cirque, tasting everything. I had a ball writing what I think was maybe the most authoritative review I ever wrote, and I didn't give them 4 stars, or the equivalent.
That's amazing. And then, you know, I totally found it despicable. There was one point I saw a Kickstarter campaign for a writer. Some local writer wanted to fund his meal at a fine dining restaurant in Tribeca with crowdfunding. And I was sort of like, I understand that writers aren't being paid these days, but this is all messed up.
Mm.
Like, someone needs to pay for it, whether, you know, and it shouldn't be crowdfunded because I don't craft my, you know, my meals. And there's sort of this right. weird nether region of food writing that needs to be more funded, but is not.
That's a whole other thing,
yeah,
definitely.
Whole other...
In my days at Gourmet, I was very lucky because...
Very lucky.
Signed a house, it was like, whatever you want to spend, just spend it. And, of course, the one inviolate thing in those days was I could not accept a free meal, which is great. You know, Condé Nast said, never take anything free. We will pay for everything. Just give us the receipts.
Fantastic. I know. Okay. Digging deep in your history, what was it like to have Martha Stewart cater your wedding? Like, that blows my mind. I don't really get it. What?
Yeah. Martha was, I married a girl from New Canaan, Connecticut, and that's Martha's stomping grounds, not originally, of course, but she had established herself in Westport as a caterer, and I think she had already published one book, but she wasn't very well known, and my ex-mother-in-law decided to go for the best of the local catering situation. The wedding was actually at my in-law's house in New Canaan, and she hired Martha, and Martha made a beautiful wedding. I mean, everything about it was really beautiful. Tent on the tennis court, which was a magical environment. The food was... I mean, I'm not going to hold her responsible for this because it was like 300 people and, you know, what can you do? It's a wedding, you know? Yeah, food was not the most memorable part. And Martha was... I like Martha. She was a little bit... slightly frosty. Don't get me too far into this, but, you know, she... looked at me. I was just transitioning from college professor to food writer, and she came up to the newlyweds and she said, "And what do you do?" I said, "I'm getting started as a food writer." She went, "Oh," and she walked away.
Interesting. <Yeah. clears throat> Okay. Hey, David, where can we see this wine manifesto that you're putting out?
Oh yeah. So, you know, that I told you before about my 10 categories of wine.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a little book about it. I call it my wine manifesto, and it's filled with red pages and kind of hammer and sickle symbols. I don't know why. It's just kind of fun. But it's really a great read, and you can find it on my website.
Cool.
Which is drosengarten.com.
And by the way, look for more from, you know, David and I are working on a trade event to be announced, where you can taste some of his wines. And then other than that, you know, we'll be eating and flushing. We'll be eating stinky tofu, getting non-Taiwanese tasting notes on stinky tofu.
That dish is a trip.
Yeah.
I've had it in Taiwan, and I've now had it with you in, where were we? In Queens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, whoa, man, if you like stinky cheese and all that kind of stuff, you got to have stinky tofu, Taiwanese. It's amazing.
Awesome. Well, on that note, we are, this is HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Leyte Su, your host on Word of Mouth with yours truly. And we're going to do a little winding down.
A little whining.
Winded down.
I hate the way they...
Okay. I would be neglectful if I didn't announce the almost end of Summer of Riesling, you know, because I was really had a fantastic time this summer working alongside the team, Paul Greco's team at Terroir, and I'm proud to say we poured 95 bottles of Riesling a day, every day this summer, so that's like over 6,000 bottles of Riesling, and wanted to just give a little Riesling lesson, because it's quite this unloved and lonely grape, and it's sad, and it's in the corner, and everyone who comes up to me goes, you know, I don't really like Riesling, it's sweet. Hey, by the way, it can be totally, totally dry to very, very sweet. It's got it all, and Riesling is not just made in Germany, but also Austria and Alsace and the Finger Lakes in our backyard and in Australia, believe it or not. And it's a grape that expresses its terroir, the place that it's grown, you know, just like you know, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in the very special Burgundy that we all love so much. And by the way, you know, Riesling is more ageable than Chardonnay. It's with, you know, it's actually more ageable from it's great sugar and acidity. And if you've got any room at all left in
your
small New York City apartment, I would recommend getting a case and forgetting about it. And then 10 years later, you're going to have some sick juice. So that's my urging of the drinking of the Riesling before the ending of the summer. And next week on Word of Mouth with Leyte Su, it's actually going to be a surprise guest. But next week, we have Patrick Capiello of Pearl and Ash. He's going to talk to us about a lot of other stuff besides the amazing, amazing wine list he's got. And then next week is Thomas Patuzak of The Nomad. And did you know he's also a professional pianist? Also, we're going to be going to the Green Market, talking to chefs we run into there about what's gorgeous and seasonal and delicious and what they're cooking up from the farms that week. So tune in again. Hope you enjoyed. Leyte Su, HeritageRadioNetwork.com, word of mouth. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.